Together we will stand, fight until fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man. Oh, yeah.
Welcome to Neighbors this morning on KUMD. A feature here on KUMD helping us connect to some of our strange circumstances during the COVID-19 pandemic and learn something in particular, of course, from the wide range of experts that we have available here at UMD. This morning, Dr. Richard Buckaloo is our guest. He is an assistant professor of mathematics here at UMD, and he's giving us some information about the math behind social distancing. Richard, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Well, when we have just seen all this video of folks over the Memorial Day weekend, right next to one another, and crowded beaches and parks, and actually video from Park Point yesterday, a lot of folks right next to each other, very few masks on display. Maybe we need a little bit of a refresher in terms of social distancing and how does it work. What does the math tell you about what social distancing can do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the math, I would say that social distancing is one way that you can affect the spread of disease. And so the maps that I'm capable of talking about is really a general approach to how diseases spread. In particular, there's a class of disease models called SIR-type models that include some characteristics of how the disease spreads. And, of course, almost all diseases spread by contact of some form or another. And so one of the things that these models show is that if you can decrease that rate of spread, then you can actually decrease the total number of people who get the disease over time. You can decrease the total number of people who need advanced health care at any one time, which can actually lower the severity of the disease and help save lives as well. So this is what's been called flattening the curve. But flattening the curve is, of course, a mathematical term because curves are mathematical objects. And so social distancing is one way, and masks are another way, and hand washing is another way. There's lots and lots of ways that you can affect what we'd call the parameters, the transmission parameters, in mathematical models that tell us what to expect from a disease.
And one of the things that you mentioned in this article where you were quoted is these models can't necessarily tell you how any individual could be affected. It's designed for thinking about populations. It's kind of a conceptual model. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I believe you'll be linking an infographic on the KUMD webpage after today. I hope the listeners will take a look at that. What I'm presenting there is a very general, very conceptual type of model where we classify the population into just three people. Epidemiological models can be very precise, down to individual people if we want to. But it's very, very hard to make accurate predictions. It's really a trade-off when you're making a model between the type of data you have available, the amount of data you have available, and the type of knowledge you want to gain from using the model. It turns out that these conceptual models where we classify the population into just a few categories, for instance, people who are susceptible to getting the disease still, people who for one reason or another are no longer susceptible, maybe they've been already infected and recovered, maybe they've been vaccinated, or maybe something worse, maybe they've actually died from the disease. And then, of course, you have people who are infectious or infected, or exposed and going to be infectious, or in the hospital, or high risk or low risk, right? You can divide the population into lots of categories. But that comes back to the trade-off, because the more categories you use, the harder it is to know that your model is a good fit for reality.
Right. So this one is comparatively simple in the sense that you have only divided people up into three categories. And the idea of this epidemic modeling is to talk about a little bit about, well, you tell me. What is the goal of this particular model? Is it talking about the efficacy of social distancing, or just to kind of demonstrate to people who might not believe it, this is how it works?
Yeah, well, the reason that I and my student put this particular model together and presented it the way we did was mainly to show that small changes in those transmission parameters can have a big impact on the outcome, on the felt reality for people in the midst of the pandemic. So, for instance, we ran the model, and it is quite a simple model, but simple models like this have really matched well with real data from real epidemics in the past. So this really is a meaningful comparison. So we took a transmission parameter. We changed it by about 14%. So the transmission parameter includes how many times you're interacting with people and or the environment in ways that still might spread the disease. And it also includes how likely any of those interactions is to lead to a transmission if one of the individuals is infectious, right? So at one extreme, you could have, you know, a big hug and a kiss. And at the other extreme, you could have both people are masked and keeping 6 feet apart and washing their hands before and after. And so you can change the characteristics of these interactions, and that's exactly what our actions have been doing here in Minnesota, around the country, and around the world. And in this model, if you change by a very modest, just about 14%, you cut the total number of people who are infected over the course of the epidemic in half, and you cut the number of deaths about in half as well. And if you further reduce that, about another 15 to 20%, then you cut the original number by a factor of 8.
Wow.
So, yeah, these are not big changes in behavior, but they have big, big effects on the course of the disease.
Now, there's obviously a lot of misinformation being circulated that unfortunately we have access to. There is disinformation. It was explained to me yesterday that misinformation is stuff that you share with honest intentions, but you're wrong and you didn't know it. Disinformation is stuff that may or may not be shared deliberately by people in an effort to skew perceptions or try to get people to think one thing or the other. At any rate, there's a lot of information available to us now. We're obviously concerned as we try to balance keeping people safe with the economic effects, and those are also a huge consideration. So you show this model to someone, and if perhaps they are not saying that there's anyone in this conversation who would fall into that category, but say you're going to share this model with someone for whom mathematics is a little bit challenging. How would you explain this to somebody who either might have a difficult time grasping it because of the math, or who's skeptical, and is maybe questioning your motivations?
Sure. It's a really fair question. It's a really important question. How do you evaluate sources? How do you evaluate the information that you're coming across? And I do have a couple of rules of thumb that I use. Of course, I have a background in mathematical modeling. Some of my graduate work did involve epidemic models. So, I maybe have a better grounding than others for this specific topic. But I'd say there's some hallmarks of people who are giving good information, giving their best knowledge and their best efforts at giving good information that are not hard to spot. So one of them is, I would say anybody who really knows what they're talking about is going to make it clear that they don't know what they're talking about for sure.
Which
sounds
okay.
like a contradiction.
Right.
But models are not 100% correct. They can't be. They're predictions, and predictions can't be 100% correct. But one of the things that a mathematical modeler does, one of the things that an epidemiologist does, is build in that uncertainty from the start. So when you're building a model, even a very simple one like the one I present, you have to ask the question, what if each aspect of this model is wrong? And so the way that that ends up coming into public information is in confidence intervals, when we see charts, for instance, from the IHME or from the UMN School of Public Health, they'll have ranges of possible outcomes on those graphs. So that's one reflection of uncertainty. They say, well, we think this is what will happen, but we can't be sure, and we think these are the most likely things to happen, but we can't be sure. And anybody who says they know for sure what's going to happen is probably way too confident.
Well, that is an excellent point to make, because whatever kinds of information we're struggling to grasp right now, we're becoming more and more aware that there is deliberate disinformation being disseminated, people who have an agenda. And I think most people really do want to, they don't want to be lied to. They don't want to be jerked around. They want to try to find accurate information. And the more tools we can add to our toolkit to help us do that, the better off we are. You were going to mention another way that people can kind of start to parse good and bad information.
Yeah. So the other thing I'd say is that nobody goes into epidemiology to fool people. It's a simple point, but I think we're forgetting, you know, who the people we're talking about are. There's a pretty strong consensus among public health professionals, people with real background and training. And I think it's important when we hear competing narratives to think about the motivations for those narratives and to think about the reason, the background, the training that a person has. Epidemiologists are people like you or me, Lisa, and they really, truly are in this with good intentions and to try and improve public health. And, so I guess another way to make sure to look for that disinformation or just misinformation is just evaluate the background, the training, the expertise that a person has. If they don't have epidemiological training, then their opinions might be strongly stated, but there's not much reason to treat them as more valuable than someone who does have that training.
And so even if a person is a scientist in a related field or a close field, I'm thinking about a friend of mine that has been publishing or posting some information from this Newt Witkowski, and he was at Rockefeller University. His credentials seem fairly impeccable, but he's been controversial. They took down his information on YouTube because his sense is he seems to be promoting an idea that you just let everybody do whatever they want and herd immunity will kick in. Everybody gets exposed and then, you know, we may lose some grandparents and some people with existing health conditions. But basically, that's the way to get everybody past this whole social distancing business. And not everybody agrees with his point of view.
Sure. So I'm glad you brought up herd immunity, because essentially there's two ways to eradicate a disease, and herd immunity is one of them. The other one is what we've seen be very successful against COVID-19 in other countries such as South Korea and New Zealand, where they have been aggressively tracing people's contacts when someone is sick. and they interact with someone else, then they'll notify that other person, they'll quarantine them, and cut off the spread right where it happens. So immunity can actually be at a society level, not just at an individual level. There are plenty of diseases that have been eradicated using a herd immunity strategy. I'd point to, for instance, smallpox, measles until recently anyway. Measles is nearly eradicated in the U.S. And, of course, most people haven't got smallpox. Most people haven't got measles. What herd immunity means is enough people are immune to the disease that if one person gets it, they're not going to be able to spread it to anybody around them because most of the people they encounter will be immune. And there's lots of ways to get immunity to a disease. Vaccines are the main way we do that, and they're the way that we've eliminated many other diseases. So herd immunity does not mean everybody has to get the disease, and it definitely doesn't mean we need to sacrifice our loved ones.
I'm relieved to hear that. Richard, thank you so very, very much for joining us this morning. And we're going to do exactly that. We're going to get links up to the infographics that you provided so that folks can get some additional information and they can look this over and parse this through at their leisure. Thank you again so much for joining us this morning. It was great to have you.
I'm glad to be with you, Lisa. Thanks very much.
Dr. Richard Buckaloo is an assistant professor of mathematics here at UMD.
Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone.
Someday, it is 10:17, and this is Neighbors on KUMD. Sarah Zimmer joins us this morning. She is an associate professor of biomedical sciences at the University of Minnesota Medical School, Duluth campus. She joins us this morning to talk about the importance of face masks in COVID-19 prevention. So first we talk social distancing, and now we're talking about the importance of face masks. Sarah, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, good morning, and what a sunny sort of morning it is, I guess.
I got to tell you, that I am looking forward to. So face masks have suddenly become political, which seems a little bit strange to me. Why are they important? And assuming that someone perhaps challenges us for wearing or not wearing a mask, and we don't want to pick a fight, we want to just have an exchange of information. What do we need to know about wearing masks and the transmission of the disease?
Well, maybe you should have hired a communication specialist for that specific question. But I can tell you, I can certainly tell you that as a scientist, the politicization of the mask situation seems kind of irrelevant or strange, because in my sphere, it's all about what works and what doesn't work. But I can understand how these things happen, because when we're receiving information, we're often not necessarily getting all the context. And, previous to where we are now in this pandemic, we received some information that might have been a little bit conflicting about masks compared to what we know right now. I guess my graduate student was talking to me, and she might have said it best. She said, as a scientist, I am accustomed to thinking in probabilities and likelihoods. And it just occurred to me that the rest of the world doesn't do that. To them, it's, are masks good or are masks bad? Are masks effective or are masks not effective? And what we probably, the context maybe that's missing is that masks, when used consistently by a large number of people, will lower risks. They won't completely eliminate, but they will certainly lower the amount of material that may be transmitted from people that are expelling this coronavirus into the environment. And if that is reduced, if the amount of the virus that goes into the environment is reduced, then there's a reduced chance that somebody else is going to be picking up an amount that is going to be able to make them sick. Did you see how many more words it took for me to describe that? I mean, it's not surprising that sometimes we leave that context behind when we have these conversations.
And I think that it is important for journalists to get a better grip on the importance of providing that context to people and not being quite as concerned about peripheral nonsense and being a little more concerned with taking the time to tell the story that needs to be told. My producer in the other room just remarked his way of saying almost what you said in different words is it can't hurt. So, yeah, you can also encapsulate it that way. I was curious about what you said about how what we know about masks, for example, has changed since the beginning of the pandemic. I know that at one point, the fancy 3M masks with the little Darth Vader respiratory thing were the ones that, you know, oh, these are the only ones that really work. And then cloth masks, well, that isn't going to do any good. Germs can go in and out, you know, through them. And then cloth masks, yeah, that's not a bad idea at all. Talk a little bit about how our attitudes about masks and the kinds of masks we should be wearing have changed as we've gone through what seems like several lifetimes just in a matter of months.
I think we started by really looking at the question of how do we protect ourselves? And if you are somebody who has to work with somebody who has COVID-19, you know, how do you protect yourself from getting that infection as a healthcare worker or as a family member? And really, that knowledge hasn't changed that much. Those masks that you mentioned are called N95 masks, and they seal all the way around, you know, all the way around. They are specially formulated so that they catch a very high percentage of any viral particles that may be in aerosols in the air that somebody might have expelled, either if they were symptomatic and coughed or asymptomatic and were just talking. And then you breathing in through that filter is going to eliminate so many of those viral particles that you're probably not ever going to receive an amount to get sick. And that hasn't changed. That's absolutely still true. So if you needed to protect yourself from getting sick and you were in this high probability situation that you were exposed to COVID, the coronavirus, it would work. The trouble is those masks have to be properly used. Those masks are not in very high supply. So then the question shifted over time to how can we make it possible for less people to be infected? How can we lower the amount of viruses that get into the environment in the first place? And that's where just wearing any kind of mask helps. Now, it's different. It's not like this will protect you. It's more if you wear this mask and everybody around you is also wearing this mask, then if any of you are expelling viral particles and you don't know it, you are going to lower the number that get into the environment, not eliminate, lower the number. But enough of you are lowering the number, then those levels will go down so much so that less people overall will get sick. And it's really a large group perspective versus an individual, am I protected?
Well, not only that, part of what you're talking about is it's not a question of whether or not you feel okay. It's not a question or not of whether or not you are worried that you are in a high-risk group. That has nothing to do with it. The issue is the more people that wear masks, the less virus is in the environment, if I'm understanding, and the less likely it is that somebody is going to get sick from it, whoever that might be.
That was a lovely way of summing it up. Yes. Yes. And so you're really wearing masks. And this is a good argument, I guess, if you were looking at how to defend your use of a mask. Which you shouldn't have to defend, but if somebody was challenging you on it, certainly you are not doing it for your sake. You're doing it for the sake of everybody around you, and probably a little for your sake. But, you know, just really it's for the purposes of making sure that the population is more protected than it would have been if nobody was wearing masks.
So the importance of the masks and the politicization or the people kind of getting off on these tangents about, you know, freedoms and whatever. Now, as we've changed the focus and the importance of the mask, in a sense, that becomes significant now in a way perhaps that it wasn't at the beginning, because now the point is for everybody or as many people as possible to wear a mask. So what do scientists do when they know that this is a course of action that should be taken to keep people safe, and suddenly they're butted right up against a bunch of ideas and attitudes in a situation that really isn't scientific?
What do scientists do? Well, it's interesting. My perspective of having to contain infectious material really comes from my own lab. So in my lab, I work with an organism that is much, much larger than a virus, and so it doesn't really get into aerosols unless you really force it. And so there's different considerations, but I spend a significant amount of time writing up protocols to say this is how we're going to do our science so that nobody who's working with the infectious material that's in my lab gets sick from it. And so it seems very logical, and there's no argument about it. It's like this will help us to not get infected, and it's very clear, and that's the end of the discussion. And I think it gets much, much more difficult when we, again, get into these environments where people don't have as much context as they would really need to be able to understand what's going on. I also think that there's a lot more anger and fear about things that have happened to people as a result of this, as a result of the pandemic, that don't have anything to do with how the virus is transmitted, and that creeps into how they feel about masks. So it might actually not be anything about transmission that is driving some of the things that myself as a scientist don't necessarily understand and can only speculate on, which is what I'm doing right here.
What a fascinating idea. So if somebody were to get in your face, you could say to them politely, are you displacing your rage?
No, that might not make them feel any less angry, but it might be accurate.
Yeah, this is why I try not to have conversations with people, because I'm not always really very good at it. Sarah?
Yeah, there's some things that may be true, but maybe should not be said. And I'm not saying that these people are uninformed or whatever, but, you know, even for me, when I go into a place now and everybody's wearing masks compared to when we weren't, what it tells me is definitely things are not normal. And I don't like that. I don't like that things are not normal. I want them to be normal, and I wish I could go back to work with my lovely office and be able to interact in my normal way with everybody that I normally do. So it's not that I am enjoying this life any more than anybody else is. I guess have a lot more information from that scientific realm that it looks different to me as a scientist.
And yet, the information that you've shared and the context you've shared with us now, when we go into a place and we see people wearing masks, we can thank them because they're doing their part to try to keep us safe, just as we are.
And they would probably very much appreciate that, because I'm sure they're not always getting thanked.
Exactly.
And that's something that I think we definitely have to do just from a human perspective. You know, the people that are being exposed to more viruses are those that are around people all day and confined to a specific space. And that's a lot of store employees. And so those individuals are really taking on a lot more risk than any of us who are at home and only occasionally venture into the retail environment or the grocery environment to
right.
get something that we need. So those people do deserve a pat on the back, and they certainly deserve a lot of more support than they're probably getting from the public.
Sarah, what a fascinating conversation. Thank you so very, very much for joining us this morning. What a treat.
Yes, and thank you for addressing this topic. Bye-bye.
Sarah Zimmer is an associate professor of biomedical sciences with an expertise in microbiology. She works with the University of Minnesota Medical School on the Duluth campus. You've been listening to Neighbors on KUMD.